Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. On December 5th, 2007, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Bomadine v. Bush. The case arises on a writ of habeas corpus filed on behalf of detainees currently being held by the United States at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. These detainees challenge the legality and constitutionality of their detention as enemy combatants pursuant to the Military Commissions Act of 2006. In this episode of SCOTUS Cast, Bradford Berenson, a partner at Washington, D.C.'s Sidley Austin, offers his own analysis of the case. As always, the Federalist Society itself takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Attorney Berenson.
The case of Bomadine v. Bush is the fifth in the series of the Supreme Court's decisions arising directly out of the War on Terror. This case differs from the previous four in that it tests not the extent of the Bush administration's unilateral authority to craft rules for the detention of suspected terrorists, but rather the power of Congress to enact a statute doing the same thing. Directly at issue in the case is the constitutionality of the Military Commissions Act of 2006. This statute was passed by the Congress and signed by the President in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision in Hamdan. The Military Commissions Act not only authorized the use of military commissions to try unlawful enemy combatants, but it also established a regime for the review of straight military detentions, even in circumstances where terrorists were not accused of or tried for war crimes. It's this aspect of the Military Commissions Act that is at issue in the Bomadine case. Under the Military Commissions Act, a suspected terrorist held at Guantanamo Bay receives judicial review of a limited sort in the D.C. Circuit and perhaps in the Supreme Court of the determination made by the so-called Combatant Status Review Tribunal in Guantanamo, or CSERT. The D.C. Circuit, on review of the CSERT determination, is empowered to decide whether the processes and procedures used in the CSERTs comply with the Constitution and laws of the United States, and also whether the determination of the CSERT as to whether an individual alien enemy combatant is in fact a combatant subject to detention is supported by a preponderance of the evidence. The petitioners in Bomadine allege that the Military Commissions Act, in setting up this procedure, effected an unconstitutional suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. In response, the government has made two basic arguments. The government contends that the constitutional core of the habeas corpus right does not extend at all to alien enemy combatants held outside the United States by our military. It was on this basis that the D.C. Circuit below rejected the petitioner's claims. In any event, the government argues that even if some constitutional habeas corpus rights were to be recognized in the Guantanamo detainees, those rights have not been unconstitutionally suspended by the Military Commissions Act because the Act puts in place an adequate substitute process for habeas corpus, at least habeas corpus of the form to which alien enemy fighters have traditionally been entitled. As the arguments laid out in the briefs, there were essentially three points of major dispute between the petitioners and the government. The first is whether habeas corpus rights as a constitutional matter extend at all to people in the position of the Guantanamo detainees, that is to say, people in military detention outside the sovereign territory of the detaining power. The second question, if the court concludes that the answer to the first one is yes, is whether Guantanamo Bay really is outside the sovereign territory of the United States. The petitioners, relying on a standard articulated in the Rasool decision, say that as long as the United States has exclusive jurisdiction and control over a territory, then that's sufficient for the constitutional habeas corpus right to extend. By contrast, the government argues that true territorial sovereignty has traditionally been the test under the existing Anglo-American case law. The third and final issue is the adequate substitute issue. That is, if the Guantanamo detainees have constitutional habeas corpus rights, whether those rights have been unconstitutionally abridged by the Military Commissions Act or instead have been respected through the MCA's substitution of the appellate review in the D.C. Circuit for the traditional habeas corpus procedure. Most close observers of this case have assumed that the final issue, the adequate substitute issue, would be the closest and most important and most difficult issue in the case, and the one that would consume most of the court's attention. And following the oral arguments in the Boumediene case, it appears that the close observers were correct. Going into oral argument, based upon what the justices have said in previous cases, either in the Supreme Court or in Chief Justice Roberts' case when he was sitting on the D.C. Circuit, it seemed quite clear that the government started with four votes, Scalia, Thomas, the Chief, and Justice Alito, and the petitioners started with four votes, Souter, Breyer, Ginsburg, and Stevens. The deciding vote in this case, as in so many cases, looked to be Justice Kennedy. And based upon Justice Kennedy's prior writings, most observers believed that he would conclude that some measure of habeas corpus right did extend at least to Guantanamo Bay, pursuant to some kind of a one-off rule about the particular status of Guantanamo. Thus, observers have focused on what Justice Kennedy would think about the extent to which the Military Commissions Act created an adequate substitute for the habeas corpus rights that he believed attached to the suspected terrorists at Guantanamo Bay. The experts may not always be right, but they appear to have been right in this case. From the oral argument, it seems quite correct to say that the government has four clear votes, the petitioners have four clear votes, and Justice Kennedy's opinion will be the one that decides the outcome of the case. It also appears correct to say that Justice Kennedy did not seem very interested in any ruling that would hold flatly that habeas corpus rights do not apply to the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. At one point in the oral argument, he made a rather sarcastic remark about what the Supreme Court's decision would look like if it ruled that way. Thus, the prognostications made about his controlling the outcome and that outcome depending on his views of the MCA as an adequate substitute seem certainly to be correct, at least if the tea leaves at oral argument can be read as reliable. Interestingly, however, the tea leaves regarding his views of the adequate substitute argument are not very clear and not very easy to read. Justice Kennedy did not ask many questions at oral argument, and those he did ask did not provide an extremely clear indication as to where he came out. Justice Kennedy's first question suggested a view that would preserve traditional habeas corpus jurisdiction alongside the D.C. Circuit's jurisdiction to review the CSIRT determinations pursuant to the MCA and the Detainee Treatment Act, whose standards the MCA incorporates. If the point of view implicit in this question were thought all the way through, it would lead to the anomalous circumstance that the terrorist detainees at Guantanamo Bay would have rights superior to those even of traditional criminal defendants in the civilian justice system, in the sense that they would have both a traditional habeas corpus remedy in district court and the separate appellate remedy in the D.C. Circuit provided for by Congress in the Military Commissions Act. It would also have the anomalous implication of the district courts in the District of Columbia, in effect sitting as courts of review over the D.C. Circuit. For this reason, it seems difficult to accept that Justice Kennedy will ultimately conclude, and the decision of the court will ultimately endorse, the notion that the MCA procedures exist and can be used and exhausted by the detainees, after which they will have recourse to a traditional habeas corpus remedy in district court. Although that appeared to be the implication of Justice Kennedy's initial question, later questions suggest a somewhat different and perhaps more nuanced view. Later in the argument, Justice Kennedy seemed quite concerned to clarify that the scope of the D.C. Circuit's review under the Military Commissions Act would allow it to entertain many of the kinds of substantive claims that the petitioners attempted to insert into this case in the Supreme Court, but which it seems clear the Supreme Court will not address here. For example, the petitioners have attempted to argue that the definition of alien enemy combatant embodied in the Military Commissions Act, which provides the basis for their continued detention following CSIRT determinations, is too broad, is illegally broad, and violates international law and other standards. Justice Kennedy's questioning made clear that he was interested in ensuring that the D.C. Circuit could entertain such claims by individual petitioners pursuant to the procedures under the Military Commissions Act. Implicit in this line of questioning is the possibility that Justice Kennedy will refuse to strike down the Military Commissions Act as an unconstitutional suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, but instead would favor a ruling which says that the Guantanamo detainees have constitutional habeas corpus rights, and in the course of availing themselves of the Military Commissions Act remedy, they may present arguments to the D.C. Circuit in the first instance to the effect that the Military Commissions Act procedures violate the suspension clause. That would be consistent with the MCA's standard of review for D.C. Circuit appeals and would allow the lower courts in the first instance to consider on particularized records claims of procedural unfairness and claims about the precise scope of the suspension clause as it applies in this unusual context. If this is indeed where Justice Kennedy is heading, then the real reason for granting cert in the case is simply to reverse the decision of the D.C. Circuit to the effect that the suspension clause has no application and to make clear that as the Detainee Treatment Act and Military Commissions Act procedures are employed, the lower courts need to consider the suspension clause implications of various procedural arguments the detainees may wish to make. This sort of holding would, of course, be a loss for the government, but like many of its previous losses in war on terror cases, it would be a rather modest loss that postpones many of the most difficult questions to later rounds of litigation. In the end, the stakes in the Boumediene case are high. What is really at issue is the extent to which the Supreme Court is going to constitutionalize and therefore judicialize detainee treatment policy. It seems reasonably clear that at least five members of the court, including Justice Kennedy, are prepared to constitutionalize and judicialize these issues to at least some degree. But the best reading of the oral argument suggests that the precise degree to which this will be done may remain unclear for quite a while. There may yet need to be other decisions by the D.C. Circuit and other cert petitions to the Supreme Court before it is possible to determine what the court's view is of the extent of the deference owed to the political branches of government in formulating detainee treatment procedure and policy. In the end, this fight boils down to claims by the petitioners of procedural unfairness in the regime enacted by Congress in the Military Commissions Act, weighed against the claims of wartime exigency and necessity made by the administration. Former Solicitor General Seth Waxman for the petitioners, in his rebuttal argument, pounded home the theme strongly that the procedures under the MCA are inadequate when compared to the procedures familiar to all American lawyers from the civilian criminal justice context. The greatest strength of the petitioner's argument is what former Solicitor General Waxman returned to in his rebuttal. Horror stories regarding how these procedures work in practice and the practical obstacles that a detainee who may be held in error would have in establishing his innocence. The strength of the government's arguments lie in the historical scope of the writ, the existing Anglo-American law on habeas corpus, and the reality of tremendous judicial deference throughout history to the judgments of the political branches, and particularly the executive, in deciding how to meet and deal with a military threat. In short, the government's strongest argument is that the baseline for evaluating fair habeas procedure in the context of war, even assuming that habeas corpus remedies apply to alien enemies held outside the United States, is not the familiar baseline implicitly appealed to by former Solicitor General Waxman, that is, the civilian criminal justice context, but rather the very different baseline that applies to those unfortunate individuals who take up arms in the course of a military conflict and find themselves captured. For now, it appears that the Supreme Court is unlikely to fully resolve those claims, but will instead take one further, relatively modest step in the direction of making the federal courts regular actors in the conduct of hostilities in the War on Terror.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.